Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
But I want to talk about Manchester United to begin with, because of course there are a lot of Manchester United fans very, very unhappy indeed this morning. United away fans, whatever you think is the fan base as a whole, you know, all the usual jokes about, oh yes, you know, their home games are all in London and they're all based in Surrey or Essex. Yeah, it's all very funny, but generally, the Manchester United away fans are pretty punchy. You know, they're pretty loud, good supporters. Actually, I mean, most away fans are, because if you're frankly mad enough to follow your team home and away halfway across the country, spend all that money and petrol and time going to watch your team, and God bless the people who do, if you're one of them, you're not there to sit at the back and eat your sandwiches quietly, are you? You're there to sing and cheer and chant and shout. So, yeah, generally away fans are pretty loud. And United fans for the first half at Huddersfield yesterday were very loud. But by all accounts, they did not finish the game singing about Ole being at the wheel. Actually, Ole isn't at the wheel anymore. Realistically, ever since Ole got given the job full-time, he appears to have been down the galley drinking whiskey and dancing Irish jigs with Kate Winslet. That's the kind of thing it's been. They have hit an iceberg in their season. Solskjaer won 14 of his first 19 matches in charge at United, which obviously earned him the permanent job, and there are merits to that decision. You give the players a bit more stability, you're in contract talks with a number of them, and you give them a bit more of a chance to know what they're signing up for. I wouldn't want to sign a contract anywhere unless I knew who my boss is going to be. You wouldn't want to go for a job interview and they say, oh yes, I'm interviewing you, also this guy here and this woman here. Oh, but none of us are going to be here by the time you actually start. So really, we're just here to see if you're any good and then we'll hire you and then it'll be someone else who'll be in charge. If you don't know who that is, you'd be mad to sign that contract or take that job. It would be insane to ask a player to do that. So I can understand why the United board felt they could and should give Ole Gunnar Solskjaer the contract. But it seems to have made some sort of change, whether in the mentality or in the commitment of the players, I don't know. Since the baby-faced assassin got the contract, he's seen just two victories over his for his side. They failed to keep a single clean sheet. Now, Ben will tell me that fans don't care about clean sheets as long as they're winning. Well, they're not winning and they're not keeping clean sheets. And I think, actually, defensive stability is rather important. Just ask Liverpool, who spent £75 million on a centre-half, reinvented the art of defending in their side, and now they're challenging for a Premier League title. And yesterday, United became the first top six side to drop points against one of the relegated teams, which in itself is a remarkable statistic that probably needs a little bit of investigation. But it's not the first time that someone has suggested to me, and I'm starting to believe it, that United might be being left behind by the rest of the top six. I've spent all season talking about the top six and the bottom 14. And now that United have missed out on Champions League football for next season, it's not that unlikely they might slip a bit further forward. A bit further backwards. I'm so used to United going forwards, but they might be going backwards now. And even Solskjaer was forced to admit that they don't deserve to be in Europe's elite competition.
We're all disappointed we're not in the Champions League, but I think that's a true reflection. The table seldom lies at the end.
He's right, the table doesn't lie, and United are a poor side. They have been for a while. It's a sign of the gulf, perhaps, that they have been as poor as they have been. They're still 9 points clear of Wolves with a game to go. I've been talking about this top six and the bottom 14 and who might be able to bridge that gap. Wolves, Everton, Watford, Leicester maybe. Can they somehow break through into that top six? Well, actually, yeah, someone can bridge that gap, and it's Manchester United. They're going to build a bridge backwards somehow. I don't quite know the sort of engineering of that, but that's what they're going to do. They're going to bridge this gaping chasm between the Champions League and Europa League sides and the rest by being poorer and poorer every season. And it's because they failed to adapt. You know, we talk a lot about they haven't got a director of football, they haven't got a technical director, means they've got no direction. It seems like an obvious thing. I'm sure they have some direction, but they don't seem to be able to stick by it. And they also haven't realised what's successful in the Premier League. You know, this is one of the greatest teams in the world in terms of success, in terms of fan base, commercial size, and yet they haven't caught up with the rest of the league. Who's at the top of the Premier League, right? Liverpool and Manchester City. What do those two teams have in common? A, stability of leadership, the same manager for a number of seasons. And B, they play high-pressing, high-intensity, attacking football. Now, when you look at United's transfer strategy, and they have this famous three-in, three-out strategy, so don't make big changes quickly. If you do that, if you make slow changes, you've got to keep making the same sorts of changes, otherwise you don't go anywhere. You just row on one side and then row on the other, and you end up in the same bit of water. But look at the players United have signed. Romelu Lukaku. Is that a modern footballer? I think he's very good. He's got a good goals-to-minutes ratio. But if you want to play the football that the top sides in Europe are playing, Romelu Lukaku's not your man. Nemanja Matic. If you want to play the football the top sides in Europe are playing, Nemanja Matic is not your man. Fred. Diego Dalot, even. They're not players. Zlatan Ibrahimovic. They're not players who fit in with what modern successful football teams do. And that's where I look at United's long-term strategy and think, blame Ed Woodward if you want. But actually this comes down to an overall failure, an overall belief that the United way is the right way, and an inability for Ed Woodward to listen to other ideas. You know, he has said and been successful in business by saying, we are Manchester United, we don't have to change the way we do things. That works in a commercial environment, where United have a brand to protect. But in football, because you have the league table that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer says doesn't lie, the league table makes you change. In commercial business, you can sign a 5-year contract for X million pounds a year, and that has to be paid every year. In the Premier League, there are no guarantees. Finishing third one season does not guarantee that you'll finish at least sixth the next season. In the Premier League, sometimes it has felt that way, but there are no guarantees, and that's the difference. Football has this completely different metric from the business world, which means that if you start to fail, the league table will reflect it. You can't hedge. You can't create safety nets for yourself, and that's what Manchester United are going to learn the hard way next season. They haven't qualified for the Champions League, they've got a bloke in charge with very little managerial experience, and now they've got to try and sign some players to stop them finishing 8th next year.
Love Sport.
Now, Arsenal were held to a 1-1 draw against Brighton yesterday. Let's have a little listen to Seagulls boss Chris Hughton. He said after the game, his side were left ruining their cutting edge in front of goal.
Probably, you know, the areas that we've been short is getting the goals that we need, and probably that was the case today. We had to defend really, really well, but I thought we had some chances also to go and win it.
I mean, that says everything you need to know, doesn't it, about Arsenal at the moment, when Brighton, who have only just avoided relegation, come to the Emirates, get a 1-1 draw, and think they should have won it. I don't think he's wrong, Chris Hughton. Brighton were brilliant, actually. I wondered where that Brighton had been all season. They were pressing the ball high, playing fast, counter-attacking football. It was brilliant to watch. And I did think, oh, maybe these lads could have done all right. But they didn't have much cutting edge in front of goal, and that has been their problem. Glenn Murray was their goal scorer yesterday with his 200th senior goal, would you believe it? What a career he's had. But I don't think he's a man who's going to keep many teams in the Premier League many more times in his career. Maybe he'd do a job at Arsenal. Who knows? Anyone might be able to do a job at Arsenal at the moment. It was not a good day for Gunners fans, one of whom is on the line now. Le Grove joins me. Probably not in a great mood this morning. Shall I tread carefully here?
Yeah, take it easy. It's been a very, very bad month.
Yeah, I mean, the Gunners were... Look, first 30 minutes watching it, when that penalty went in at 9 minutes in, I thought, oh, it'll be 2-3 nil here at half-time. Couple of really good saves from Matt Ryan, and then it all seemed to go to pieces. Is that just endemic of the sort of fragility around Arsenal at the moment?
Yeah, I think there's been a big correction towards the back end of the season. I think Emery rode his luck with the first 22 games. We were winning, and it looked like we were resilient, but underlying statistics showed that a lot of luck was going our way. And towards the back end of the season, the manager's been completely exposed. His away record has been appalling. And if you're totally honest with yourself, the manager's not really moved the club on. We're worse defensively. We're surviving on our conversion rate, you know, the best conversion rate in the league by quite a margin. And there's no style out there. You know, the fans are like the rapturous booing at the end of the game said it all. Like, Arsenal aren't interesting, Emery isn't interesting, and I think we're in a big trouble with the manager.
I mean, that's interesting to hear that you think. I think I know the answer to this question, but do you think Emery's not the answer then, and Arsenal maybe should be thinking about someone else this summer?
Yeah, I don't think that he's got pedigree at the highest level. You know, Emery's last season at Sevilla, he didn't win an away game all year. You know, he went to PSG, the most expensively assembled side in Europe, and he lost the league in his first season. And in the second season, when he won it, he was moved on. I don't think he's a great manager. I think he struggles with communication. I think when you interpret what he's trying to say, it sounds like a good plan on paper. But the reality is, if you set out to fix the defence, you say you're going to be protagonists, you can't limp in at the end of the season conceding 50 goals and, you know, having to set up negatively against teams like Everton, Leicester and Crystal Palace. Like, it's really not been good. And I think that the biggest thing Emery came in on was this video analysis. Like, what was he looking at before the Brighton game? Like, we crossed the ball into the box 41 times yesterday against two centre-backs that are absolutely dominant in the air. Like, he didn't change the game as this was going on. And like, we made a team that can't score goals look, you know, positively deadly moving forward.
Yeah, free-flowing, I thought Brighton were, which is not a word I ever thought I'd use about Brighton and Hove Albion, quite frankly. But you're right, I think that probably says as much about Arsenal as anything else. If there are positives from this season, Lacazette and Aubameyang have been incredibly potent. As you mentioned there, the conversion rate's been very, very good. Do you think it is a matter of trying to build a system where they can both play quite centrally, as opposed to, for example, building a system around Mesut Ozil? Or is there a middle way that you can involve all three?
I think Arsenal need to decide who they want to be as a club, what sort of football they want to play. Unai Emery likes to play with overlapping wing-backs, and that seems to be the only way that he likes to move the ball forward. I don't think I don't think that's a good system to build around. I love Aubameyang and Lacazette, but I don't know whether a two-striker system is the way to move forward. You kind of feel like if you had combine the two strikers, you'd have like the perfect entity, because Lacazette lacks physicality.
Yeah.
And Aubameyang can't play with his back to goal, but I think there needs to be a real rethink at the club in the summer, because, you know, we've got some of the best managers in the world like in that top six, and the clubs around us are only going to get better. So, you know, this is a pivotal moment in our history. We could be in irrelevance if we don't get it right.
Who do you think is the answer then? There's so many names that have been thrown around over the last couple of years for the Arsenal job, but have you got one in mind who you look at and think he plays the right sort of football and could do the right thing for the club?
I think from an if we were going to hire in an experienced manager, I think Jardim at Monaco is a prime candidate. Like, what he did with that youthful Monaco side was exceptional. He brought young players through. He's a real coach. He can adapt to any system. Like, he's not a checkbook manager. And, you know, he can build from the back. He can build free-flowing football. I would love to have somebody like that on board. Or, you know, a young, innovative coach that can do something interesting. Like, we cannot afford to bring in another checkbook manager. We need somebody that can coach, build an exciting way of playing, and then, you know, I think the future of Arsenal is youth and bringing in the best talent, and then hopefully building in the same way that Liverpool did, maybe sell a couple, you know, build up that transfer kitty.
Yeah, it's interesting, the innovative manager approach. There's a few of them starting to emerge now, you know, mostly in Germany for whatever reason, and whether that's the answer, I don't know, but it might well be. I have to ask you about Aaron Ramsey. Really emotional scenes. Not nice to see, but you know what I mean when I say it was nice to see a bloke who really cares about a football club yesterday on the pitch, sort of clawing the tears out of his eyes, trying not to get too emotional. Are you sad to see him go?
Absolutely. It's a devastating free transfer. And Arsenal have made a lot of bad moves over the last 5 years. But I think if you ask the fans, this one really cuts deep. Emery decided that he didn't fancy Ramsey in late September and then didn't play him that much until he really needed to in January. And then the crazy thing is Aaron Ramsey was almost our player of the season in the back half of the year. You know, what could he have done if he'd be given a full run in the position that he likes to play? So I think that's going to be a really, really difficult position to fill because, you know, he has so much energy and he really understood what it was to be an Arsenal player. You know, you throw him in a North London derby and no one's going to drop their level. It's a sad one. We've been through a lot with him. He's a great player and I think he's going to have a great time at Juventus.
Obviously, Danny Welbeck and Petr Cech were stood next to him. I mean, Cech, I don't think anyone will argue, should be leaving. But I heard someone say, I think it was Dave Seeger actually, saying that Welbeck could have been given a contract and it wouldn't have been the worst decision in the world. It would certainly save you going out and finding another striker because you do need to sign a striker now.
I think it would have been a terrible decision. Danny Welbeck can't maintain fitness. I mean, you look at I love his attitude. I love what he brings to the forward line. You know, there's talent there, but ultimately he's a very, very expensive battering ram. Finishing has been appalling. You know, he's 27, 28 years old now. Arsenal really need to go out and do better from a wide position and giving a player with, who can play 10, 15 games a season. That's just not value. I think we should be looking at someone like Pepe in France or Ismaël Sarr, like give the chance to somebody who's got a higher ceiling and somebody that we can really develop. I kind of think that Danny Welbeck's hit his limit and I think he's an Everton-level player at best.
I do like throwing shade at Everton, so I'll allow that. Just finally, I want to finish on maybe a positive Europa League final. The one thing about signing Unai Emery is you know you're going to get Europa League success. It's almost guaranteed. We assume it's going to be Arsenal versus Chelsea in that final. Are you confident that you've got the wood over the Blues?
We've got a very difficult game on Thursday. It's very difficult because it's Arsenal away from home.
Yeah,
but I think that we've got enough power. We did a great job in Napoli. This is Emery's trophy. I think he's really focused on being the first manager to win the Europa League four times. The slight bugbear is that by losing the top four race yesterday, Chelsea can rest all of their players next week. They can prepare. They're a team of champions. The one thing that we've got is Sarri's never won a trophy. Emery's won a number of them. So hopefully that's on our side. My big question is, does a cup final in Azerbaijan count as an away game? Because if it does, we're in trouble. Hopefully it doesn't.
Well, they draw it, don't they? So they do a sort of mandatory draw for the final and one team comes out as the away side. I don't know which one is. I'll have to check that because that could, as you say, make all the difference for Arsenal. Like, all about mentality after all. And of course, you won't have Henrik Mkhitaryan because he can't get a visa to get into Azerbaijan. So lots of different...
That's probably a good
thing. That's very mean. Be nice to him, honestly. Thanks really so much for coming on, LeGrove. I know it's a difficult day for you, but I'm sure you'll feel better when the sun comes up again tomorrow. Arsenal will still be bad away from home and it'll be Tuesday, but we'll be all right. That's LeGrove, of course. Make sure you check out his blogging because he really is one of the best bloggers around and also one of the best talkers on the game. That's why we get him on Up Front with James Gray.
Love Sport.
Because it's Bank Holiday Monday, it means that we're in the middle of the final of the World Snooker Championship, of course, and it looks like it's going to go Judd Trump's way, 12-5 up in the best of 35 frames final. On the line to talk to us about it is Martin Gould, professional snooker player himself, been there, done that when it comes to snooker. Martin, I mean, brilliant performance from Judd yesterday, 8 consecutive frames. I mean, what can you say about Judd Trump other than when he's on that form? There's not a huge amount you can do, is there?
There isn't a lot you can do, no. Good afternoon. It was, I think, the coming of age, really, for him yesterday. Like, we always knew that he was capable of doing this kind of thing, but just over the last few months, he's really completed the whole package of his game. He's got the safety. Obviously, we know his long potting and his cue power, etc. But last night, it was just... funnily enough, 2011, when he got to the final, I played Judd in the second round and he played like that against me then. And I said to him afterwards, I said, you must win it this year. Obviously, he lost to Higgins in the final that year, but he's playing similar stuff. But it's, as I heard on the commentary last night, it was controlled flair. It was nothing too flashy. The odd flashy shot, like behind the back of his, behind his back and stuff like that. But it was just, I think, in fairness to John, John didn't really do anything wrong. He's had, what, three centuries and won five frames. Judge just blown him away, really.
It's funny, though, some games of snooker, you wait and you say, oh, well, the person who raises their level highest or first here will win the game. Yesterday, it felt a little bit like in the first seven or eight frames, the first person whose levels drop here is going to lose a big part of the match. And yeah, as you say, there wasn't a huge amount he can do. When you're playing someone like Judd, and you mentioned the controlled flair thing, do you adjust the way you play to sort of temper for that? Do you put him in different types of positions knowing the way that he plays?
Well, you do attempt to. You do try and maybe slow him down a little bit. But the problem is then you're kind of throwing yourself out of a rhythm. So there is a plus side and a downside. If you can get him missing a few from doing it, it's not a problem. But the fact of the matter is, can you then get yourself back into that rhythm again? So you know that you can punish the mistakes. Like John missed one or two last night that you wouldn't normally miss. But that was mainly because he'd just been sat in that chair. And he's probably still got a nice little print there from where he's been from last night.
Yeah, he did spend a long time sitting in the chair. It must be hard as well. You know, snooker is a game where you do need to warm up. You do need to have the feel of the table. It must be so hard when you've spent so much time watching your opponent potting balls. When that one opportunity comes, you're completely cold, aren't you?
You are. It's quite surprising how cold you can be. But John's one of those players, though. He's been there, done it, got T-shirt, he's got everything. So he's going to be really experienced in this situation. So I reckon it will definitely go to a final session tonight. But I would, like last year's final, John was way behind and come back. So it depends on how Judd is this morning.
I wonder exactly.
Every day is a different day.
Yeah, I wonder exactly how John will come out, because it's not really in his nature to come out all guns blazing. You know, I mean, not necessarily that would be the right thing to do, but certainly at 12-5 down, you'd be tempted to come out and try and pot every ball. But he's not that sort of player, really, is he?
No, he's not really that type of player, but maybe him trying that could throw Judd off a little bit, because he might not be expecting that. And especially if for instance, say John makes 2-1 visit starts this afternoon by going for everything, it's going to get Judd thinking a little bit of what could go on. It's going to be really interesting to see how, I think the first four frames this afternoon will dictate whether it will go to an evening and how far it will go this evening.
Yeah, because you'd think if John doesn't win three of those first, you know, if it's 2-2 in the first mini session, you'd think you've got to start making inroads into that deficit. Look, we expect Judd to win. From 12-5, it would be an almighty choke almost if he didn't win, and huge credit to Higgins as well. But I think for a lot of people, casual people following the game, you know, the types of people who maybe only watch the UK champs and the world twice a year, they will be surprised that Judd hasn't won a world title thus far. Do you think now that he potentially has the world championships under his belt, he will go on and win a lot of big titles now?
It's very possible. It'd be interesting to see, assuming he wins, how he takes to that pressure of being world champion to every event. Because not every player, if you look back at 2015, Stuart Bingham won the Worlds and he didn't really have a very good season the following one. I'm not saying that he deserved to be world champion, obviously. He played phenomenal for that fortnight. But I don't think he kind of handled the pressure of going to every event. Being, as much as it must have been really nice for him to be introduced as world champion to every event, everyone's got their eyes on you.
Yeah.
So any slight mistake, any sort of bad defeat or anything, you get a lot of stick for. So it'd be interesting to see if Judd does go on and win, how he reacts to that pressure of knowing that He's going to be introduced to every event as a world champion.
Every time he loses, the headlines are going to say, world champion beaten by X, Y or Z.
Yeah, well, in Ronnie's case, numpty.
Yeah, quite. Martin, thanks so much for coming on. Always a pleasure to have you on and talk about the World Snooker Championship final, which will resume this afternoon, of course, with Judd Trump 12-5 up against John Higgins. Martin Gould there, professional snooker player in his own right, currently world number 29. He's been as high as 11, though, by the way. It would be an almighty comeback for John Higgins to win this from 12-5 down in a best of 35. But I think more than anything, it would be an almighty mistake on Judd Trump's part to blow that sort of lead, something that leaves scars. We hope it doesn't, actually, because Judd is one of the stars of the game. He's exciting to watch. And if Ronnie's not around and one day it'll happen, we need someone like Judd.
Love sport.
Let's move on to footballing farewells, shall we? Because we've had a few in the last week or so. Yesterday at the Emirates, there was a post-match presentation, quite a lengthy one, for three... I don't know if club legends is the right word, but people certainly approaching that. And in Aaron Ramsey's case, definitely a club legend. He's been there. He's played more than 300 times for the club over his 10-year spell at the Emirates. And yeah, I think legend is the right word. And he was understandably emotional on the pitch, as with the other two, actually, Danny Welbeck and Petr Cech. Obviously, very different types of contributions to Arsenal Football Club. Petr Cech's had 40 Premier League clean sheets at Arsenal, by the way, which I think surprises people. He's obviously been there 4 years. I think he's played about 130 times in the league. So it does surprise people when you see he's had 40 clean sheets, but he's done a lot of good things for the Gunners. And at the end of his career, yeah, he's not looked particularly sharp. I don't think he's been great, but he's been there or thereabouts for a long time. I think he's retired a year too late. I remember watching him at the Emirates and thinking, last season, even in warm-up, thinking, just don't look as sharp as you used to. Obviously, it hasn't helped that he's then had a manager come in who wants him to play with his feet. And much as he says it, he's clearly not as good at it as others. Actually, funnily enough, Bernd Leno had quite a bad day yesterday with his feet, but that's neither here nor there. You know, Cech doesn't look as sharp, and people have been saying, oh, should he have retired a year earlier? Well, from a sort of empirical standpoint, yes. I think he probably should have done. I think he'd have been better off not playing this year because he's not impressed. But I don't think it's going to tarnish his legacy because I don't think that's what happens. I don't think players, we remember them. Yeah, sure. For the next 3 months, we're going to talk about how bad Petr Cech was in his last season. But in 3 years' time, and Chelsea fans out there, I know you will tell me how brilliant he was at Chelsea and you will always remember him for that. But there are a lot of people who will, at least in the very short term, remember him for some mediocre performances at Arsenal. But don't forget that he played an unbelievable 494 times for Chelsea. The man has 200 Premier League clean sheets. 202, sorry, to give him his full tally. And let's not underrate longevity. It's an important thing. Not everyone can stay fit all the time. All right, goalkeeping, it's not a position you generally get injured as much as others. But you've still got to be there. And plenty of goalkeepers have had careers ended by injury or just loss of form. And Cech, throughout that period, was very, very impressive. He even had, of course, a famously serious injury, that fractured skull, which meant that he wore a scrum cap for the rest of his career, which, frankly, for a man with his hairline, was something of a blessing. But that's neither here nor there. I think we should remember Petr Cech for all the good things that he did. Even if, in the short term, we might remember that last season and think, probably should have gone a year earlier. Aaron Ramsey, meanwhile, there's so many different things we will remember him for. Let's have a listen to what he said on the pitch. He was speaking to Sky Sports about his emotional Arsenal goodbye.
It's been a hell of a journey. 11 years of my life. So much has happened in that. And yeah, when I look back, yeah, you can tell by my voice how much it means to me. So I'm just grateful for the opportunity to play for this great club.
Yeah, you can hear Aaron Ramsey's voice cracking there and the tunes of Depeche Mode in the background, of course. Barely able to hear Ramsey over it, frankly. And I think he will be sad, obviously, very emotional to leave behind a club he's been at for so long. But also, I think the fans won't be very happy about life either, because they're letting a guy go who's A, been a terrific servant to Arsenal Football Club, and B, he's a type of player they don't have very much of. He's very direct, he's got a good range of passing, he adds a goal threat. but in the end, I think the fitness kept up, caught up with him. I heard an interesting line yesterday, speaking to Dave Seeger, the Arsenal fan show here on Love Sport, every Monday, of course, from 7pm. Speaking to him, and he said that basically Ramsey's got a new agent, an inexperienced one, and Arsenal put the offer on the table, and his agent offered it round. He said he went to all the other top clubs and said, this is what Arsenal are offering, can you do better? And when Arsenal found out, they withdrew the contract. That is a case, for me, of Arsenal mismanaging a business decision and it's affected a playing decision. That just shouldn't happen. If you've got a good relationship with the player and the agent, you can avoid that happening. I understand why they did it, but I think it means essentially that they are losing a good player, a talented player, who could actually have some impact on their season. It's a shame, really. Another farewell, of course. Gary Cahill was on the pitch with his kids yesterday, saying goodbye to Chelsea fans. They were singing, he's won it all, Gary Cahill, he's won it all. He has won it all. He's been an extremely successful man throughout his career. I mean, remember, he started at Aston Villa, actually. Bolton was probably where he was most impressive. It won him a move to Chelsea, and there he also won 61 caps for England and 5 goals, only 1 goal away from home in Bulgaria, funnily enough. I don't know if that means anything, but he also won 2 Premier League titles, 2 FA Cups, a Champions League, a League Cup, a Europa League. He's been PFA Team of the Year 3 times, and of course he was Bolton Wanderers Players Player of the Year in 2009. Let's not forget that bauble, of course. Ben, you're a Chelsea fan. Sad to see him go?
Very sad to see him go. I mean, it's not come to the perfect ending under Sarri. He hasn't played much this season. Even the likes of Ethan Ampadu have played more football than Gary Cahill. It is sad to see him end, and it's another Chelsea great going as well. There aren't too many left. I think probably in the pipeline, you'll probably see David Luiz is probably the most senior person at Chelsea. So yeah, it is upsetting to see Gary Cahill leave Chelsea.
Nearly 300 games for the club, as you say, only 2 Premier League appearances this season. Not the way he would have wanted to end it, of course, but his glory days, heydays. You said to me this morning, I won the Champions League on one leg. I mean, he went off with a hamstring injury in the semi, right?
Well, this is it. This is the problem that not only people were forgetting, but Chelsea fans themselves, they remember him for his last season at Chelsea, which is his rifts with Sarri, the interview he's just done in the Telegraph with Matt Law, saying that he doesn't respect Sarri, not playing that much, not really being a leader. But I will personally remember him for, he's coming on January. People forget this. He was signed January 2012. Mm. And in that, he went on to win the FA Cup and the Champions League. He went off in that semi-final against Barcelona with a hamstring injury. I think he got ran past by Iniesta, did the splits and done his hamstring in, which means that Jose Basingua has to play at centre-back. But that's a totally different story. Anyway, yeah, David Luiz was injured. Gary Cahill was injured. Everyone was suspended. No chance of winning that final, but no, he was there for 6 months, no, 5 months it would have been. The final was in May. Mm. And he's like, no, I'm playing this final. Give me all the painkillers you got. I don't care what it is. Just give me everything. I am making that final. And he practically played the game on one leg.
And he's maxed out on the painkillers and, by the way, didn't go off. He played all 120
minutes of football with one leg, a hamstring injury. Didn't play the FA Cup final because of the injury.
But let's face it, he didn't have to do much defending, did he? Who do they have up top? I mean, Thomas Müller, Arjen Robben, Frank Ribery. Who are these people? Mario Gomez, never heard of him, mate.
Well, that was it. It was 90 minutes of defending. There wasn't any break whatsoever. Watching the final, I don't think maybe went in there half once or twice. And obviously the corner kick which Drogba scored. Yeah. That's about it from Chelsea. The rest of it was pure defending.
I'll tell you what, just looking at that final, if we can relive some of Gary Cahill's glory moments. The Chelsea bench on that night, there are some absolute names there. Including Oriol Romeu, Ross Turnbull, and Daniel Sturridge. I mean, honestly, who knew where their careers would go?
You look at some of the celebratory photos and the people in the squad, you look at them and go, who are you? Why are you here? Yeah. It's because so many people were suspended, the Champions League squad, and they used every person in that Champions League squad because there weren't many people left by the time
absolutely.
May came.
And then there was this John Terry bloke there in full kit.
Yeah.
Bizarre, isn't it?
Everyone was in full kit.
UEFA require you to be in full kit. It's a very common myth. Let's talk about, you alluded to that Gary Cahill interview with the Sunday Telegraph. Essentially, I mean, taking a pretty wild swipe at Maurizio Sarri's man management, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't blame him for doing the interview. Mm. I don't blame him for what he said. The only thing I have trouble with is the timing. After all, there is still a few games left to play, a potential Europa League final, could still win the trophies. Do you really want to be known as the player that causes the unrest in the dressing room? And this is what some Chelsea fans are seeing him as. It was nice of Sarri to actually bring him on and give him his farewell at Stamford Bridge. Personally, me, being the stubborn man I am, if I read them comments, I'm thinking I'd put Gary Cahill on the bench and have gone, no, you warm up. But I'll tell you what, after reading them quotes, there's no way I'm subbing you on to give your farewell. And we'll see how much you respect me then.
I think there probably would have been an absolute riot if Gary Cahill hadn't been given the chance to make his Chelsea farewell yesterday.
It is really sad the way it has turned down. It's happened. He says it in his interview. It's not just him it's happened to. It's happened to many Chelsea legends there. They're not actually told. Remember, John Terry's contract was ran all the way down. Even fans didn't know whether he was. Mm. Luckily, he was given another year's contract and did get a send-off in the 26th minute that he made himself.
Don't. Did Gary Cahill get subbed on in the 24th minute?
He didn't know.
No, exactly. Because he's not got an ego the size of Mars.
But even like Lampard, he didn't have a farewell, had to come back for this weird half-time pitch lap of honour.
I mean, okay.
So he's not the only one, Cahill. So I get his frustration, but, you know, coming out to do that in the time...
He wasn't good enough in the end. That was the problem. Also, speaking of Chelsea legends who were involved in that Champions League final, John Obi Mikel scored his first goal in English football for 6 years at the weekend.
What a
rattling,
man.
Rattling one in
he
for Middlesbrough.
He was man in the match for me in that final. Absolutely outstanding in that midfield alongside Frank Lampard. And he's only 32 years old, which I couldn't quite believe, actually.
Only 32.
And well, you know, he's doing all right. Well, if you want him in a side, it's the Tony Pulis side, isn't it?
John Obi Mikel, the
postman, I used to call him, because he just used to always deliver on 7 out of 10 performances.
That is very, very weak indeed.
Love Sport.
And I'm delighted to say that we're joined on the line now by AFC Wimbledon manager Wally Downes, who has finally completed, we can say it now, he's completed the Great Escape. We can play the music, we can do the whole lot. Wally, many, many congratulations.
Thanks, James.
You must be absolutely buzzing. I assume it was quite a big party on Saturday night, was it?
Well, the boys had the long journey home, but I stayed over in Sheffield as a lot of the ex-Wimbledon players came up to the game, and we stayed at Kevin Gage's hotel. So we had a little alternative one, and I stayed up there, and that was a joy to be at as well.
Yeah, I heard that this sort of reunion was going on a little bit as well. It must be nice to get the lads together again, but also to do it on a night when you've been able to achieve such a great feat. Because let's face it, Wally, you must have gone in at Wimbledon and thought, this is not going to be easy.
Well, I knew it weren't going to be easy, and it was more of a heart decision than a head decision that I made. So it was important that I got it done, really, for myself.
Going into that game, I mean, obviously there were so many permutations and the League One relegation battle was so tight. It was obviously going to be a nervy occasion. How much did you know on the touchline about what was going on elsewhere and where goals were going in and how it affected you guys?
I told them under no circumstance was anybody on the bench, and including myself, in any contact with any scores. So I think everyone around us was saying how great or what the pressure was like, blah, blah, blah. But we didn't apply any pressure on us by not knowing the scores. We came to win. And we knew that a draw would be good enough. So what else happened. We just played our game to win if we could, and then obviously get the draw if we couldn't.
How much did it mean to these players to stay up in League One? You know, I remember speaking to you a couple of weeks ago, and you said that it was a matter of just working out the right way to deploy them. How good are this group, and how much do you think they can do it again and go a bit further next year?
Well, that's as a coach, you want your players to progress and improve, and I've been saying to them all through some dark times that I could see improvement in the team that wasn't reflected in the league positions or the points tallies at times. So it was important that I kept them together and that they believed in what I was saying, and in the end we've been proved as a group to be right. It's the difficult one was just having them believe in it at the time when I was telling them. And that belief is what's shone through and what's got us to where we've got.
As I say, the bottom of League One is ridiculously tight. You know, you actually finished only 5 points off the top half of the table. Looking forward to next season, and look, the beginning of next season, a long way away, I know, but I also know that managers tend to start thinking about the next game as soon as the previous one's over. Are you already thinking about what your goals are for next season?
Well, of course, yeah. You know, the goal is to improve on what you've done this year, and in my tenure, I think the games that I've been in charge of, our league position would have been 11th, I think, or 12th, something around that area.
Yes, so, yeah, it is. Yeah, I looked at that the other day.
They proved what they can do, but if we can do it over the course of a season, that's a different story. You know, we've done it over a small amount of the season. Can we do it consistently over the 46 games?
Do you think you'd need one or two fresh legs in there, a couple of maybe experienced players, or are there certain types of player that you're looking at to bring in that might give the squad a new element?
Well, you know, we've got three lone players in, which is Aaron Ramsdale, Steve Seddon and Michael Falivi, that I've used regularly. So they're gone and I've got to replace those somehow. So that process is already underway.
Yeah.
We have experience in the team. We have Anthony Wordsworth, who's 30, and Scott Wagstaff, who's got a lot of games behind him. And so I think there's a good blend, but certainly it's a club that should be young. It's a young club, and it should have young and hungry players. So, of course, you need a mix. But, you know, I'm more than happy with the senior players that we've got in there. And it's about building a culture for the younger players to bring through themselves, because you're never too young to do the right things.
No. You mentioned Aaron Ramsdale there, and I did want to ask you about him because he has had a brilliant season. Everyone says so. Sure, I mean, you'd love to have him again next year. It sounds like you don't expect to.
You never know in football. I think the Bournemouth people have been pleased with the way he's performed in games. We've had people down watching our training sessions. I think they're happy with the progress that he's made. He seems to have enjoyed himself with us. Whether they want his progression to now be to a championship club, I would imagine that is their point of view. Is there a championship club that would take a chance on a 19-year-old? I don't know. I think he's definitely good enough to do it.
Well, he certainly impressed everyone, and I think that performance, for example, up at Luton will go down, and that might look like the point that kept you up. Wally, thanks so much for getting in touch with us. It's been, I know, slightly difficult to get hold of you, but safe trip home, and a real pleasure to speak to you, and good luck over the summer trying to get Aaron Ramsdale to stay. I know every Wimbledon fan I know has been telling me how much they want him to stay, and I'm sure you will as well. That's Wally Downs there, AFC Wimbledon manager. He, of course, oversaw the great escape over the weekend there. Point away at Bradford was enough to confirm that they survived relegation from League One on goal difference by just 3 goals in the end. It doesn't get much tighter than that.
Love Sport.
Let's do our regular feature, shall we? Things you might have missed from football at the weekend. Arsene, what was your favourite bit of the game last night?
I didn't see it.
But you must have seen some funny moments in the game.
I didn't see it.
All right, what about that new Zac Efron film?
I didn't see it.
Well, at least I was watching, Arsene. I was watching everything. Everything there was to watch, I was watching over the weekend. And quite a few rather amusing moments, really. Talked earlier about Gary Cahill making his final appearance at Stamford Bridge. He was subbed on from the bench. He wasn't subbed on or off like John Terry in the 26th minute or the 24th minute, as it would have been for Cahill, because he wears 24. Nothing like that. It was just Cahill coming on as a late substitution. Chelsea were 3-0 up. It was a token gesture from Maurizio Sarri, who'd been hung out to dry in the morning's papers by the same Gary Cahill. But yet, Sarri still thought it was important to give Cahill as many instructions as possible. Honestly, 2 minutes to go. Chelsea are 3-0 up at home. Cahill's going out to make the last of his goodness knows how many hundreds of appearances for Chelsea. And Sarri's there going, yes, so at set pieces you need to pick up this guy, or if he's not in the box, it's this guy. And I also want you to push right just when we've got the ball. When we haven't got the ball, can you just tuck in? Gary Cahill did not listen to a single word Maurizio Sarri said. There was nothing in his face suggested that anything that was going in his left ear was going anywhere near his brain. Far more interested in making sure that he walked out at Stamford Bridge for the last time in the right way. Now, there was a 5-minute stoppage in the Manchester United game yesterday. Usually this happens, you know, for an injury or something like that. There were 8 minutes of stoppage time at the end of the game because after Isaac Mbenza scored his first goal in English football, he celebrated not by tearing off his shirt or throwing a boot into the crowd or jumping into the crowd himself, but by flying, kicking the corner flag and shattering it I mean, quite impressively, really. Jackie Chan would have been happy if he'd left the corner flag in the state that Isaac Mbenza did. And it took 5 minutes to replace the corner flag. Apparently, you can't just play without one. There has to be one there. Quite the scenes at Huddersfield. Now, what about cricket? You might have missed all of the cricket the weekend. There was that much football going on. But England have played their last two games in Dublin and Cardiff. The two grounds have hardly covered themselves in glory. Malahide in Dublin is a ground that reminds me of my mate's Nigerian pop-up restaurant, because it pops up. Overnight, it appears, and then the next day, it's disappeared. At Sophia Gardens in Cardiff, it's got weird short boundaries, and there was a bit of embarrassment for the ground staff thanks to the meaty stride of David Willey, who could have suffered a serious injury, actually. Frankly, if I had the type of hair and hair band that David Willey had, I too would want the ground to open up below and swallow me whole. Well, it very nearly did for Willey. He was running up and a drain cover, a la the track in Azerbaijan a week ago in the F1, the drain cover just disintegrated under his foot. Amazingly, he didn't twist an ankle at all. He was absolutely fine, remained unhurt. But yeah, the ground staff had to run out and try some, well, successful running repairs, and I think everything managed to go off absolutely fine. Now, finally, what you might have missed from the German football this weekend was Eintracht Frankfurt's form. You have to remember that Chelsea very nearly lost to Eintracht Frankfurt away from home this weekend, and then Frankfurt went into a game away at Bayer Leverkusen. Tricky game, obviously, but Frankfurt, this is the team that held the mighty Chelsea to a 1-0 draw, so presumably they get something. They were 6-1 down at half-time. 6-1! They had 18% possession. Bayer Leverkusen had 82% possession. They completed 1,058 passes in the game. This is potentially the worst Eintracht Frankfurt performance of all time. And they didn't play much of a second team. They didn't play Luka Jovic, but Ante Rebic was playing. Filip Kostic, who had such a good game against Cesar Azpilicueta, was playing. De Costa, plenty of first-teamers in there. And yet Kevin Trapp saw 6 goals go past him. Pretty embarrassing, both for Eintracht Frankfurt and, if you ask me, for Chelsea, who now have to try and turn this around. At least they've got an away goal, I'm sure you will tell me. But they could have won 6-1.
Love sport.
It was actually quite sort of moving to see a guy who has been at the club for so long. You know, as he says, more than a decade he spent at Arsenal. You know, he arrived as a highly rated, but frankly, pretty green young player. 4.8 million Arsenal paid for him in June 2008. Said he chose Arsenal ahead of other clubs because of the pursuit of Arsene Wenger, who flew him and his family to Switzerland to talk about the plans Wenger had for him and his potential future. He was described at the time as a player with a fantastic engine, a good build, good technique and good vision. I don't think those things are wrong. Even now about Aaron Ramsey, I think all of that is probably fair in terms of a description of him as a player at the age of 28, you know, 11 years later. I do feel actually quite sorry for him, and I wonder if part of those tears are sort of regret about the way it's come about. Now, there are lots of different stories flying around about why Aaron Ramsey is leaving Arsenal on a free transfer. One is that Unai Emery basically changed his mind about Aaron Ramsey, which would to a certain extent fit in because he... We understand initially there was an offer on the table and the offer was, for whatever reason, withdrawn. Now, if Unai Emery is the man who decided he doesn't want Ramsey, it would make sense because then he didn't play Ramsey after that point for a while until he got back in the team a little bit later in the season. But you can understand why he wouldn't want to play a guy who is not staying at the club. However, he did then get him back into the team, so that doesn't really hold much water to me. The other story that goes around is that Ramsey's agent essentially took the offer that Arsenal gave him, showed it to a lot of other clubs and said, can you do better? Which might be a little bit naive, and certainly their accusation has been thrown at Aaron Ramsey's agent, a new one by the way, that he is a little naive. That may or may not be true. It's an accusation that's being put around. I would think that every agent worth his salt has good contacts at every top club, or reasonable ones anyway. And rings up and says, just by the way, Aaron's got a contract expiring next summer. We're just interested in assessing our options. Wondered if you'd be interested. And then you have a conversation and the numbers. Whether you essentially say, look, Arsenal have offered him this much, fine, but you should do that under Clarence House rules. You should do that quietly, back channels, and, you know, on the proviso that it goes no further. Now, clearly in football, that's not always the case, but if you're talking to someone you don't trust, then you shouldn't be talking to them at all. The man who's really been caught in the middle of it all is Aaron Ramsey. And you could see it. The man sobbing on the pitch at the Emirates yesterday because he's leaving the club which he's spent the majority of his professional career at the age of 28, which should be the peak of his career when you look at the type of his player, type of player he is. You can understand why he's sobbing, because he's kind of being robbed of a real opportunity. Arsenal are about to rebuild the post-Wenger era. They Mesut Ozil might leave, and if he does, or if he did, you would think that Aaron Ramsey would be right in line to be the man to replace him and to be the person who would, I think, have a team built around him. Can you imagine Aaron Ramsey? A fully fit Aaron Ramsey playing behind, let's say they play that 3-4-3 system with Lacazette as a lone striker, Aubameyang as the inside left attacking midfielder, if you like, and with Ramsey as the inside right. He could be so effective in that role. Even if you had Aubameyang playing on his own up there, Lacazette a little bit deeper, I don't mind. A fluid front three. Ramsey could be so potent with them. But he's not going to get the opportunity to do that. And I feel desperately sorry for him. I think he's basically been lost in sort of business, hasn't he? Hasn't he been lost in business? I think it's really unfortunate. And he's suffered because Arsenal didn't get it done early enough, it would seem. The tradition now is to get this done with 18 months to go on the deal. Get a contract sorted and get it signed. If they had done that at an earlier stage, maybe Aaron Ramsey's agent would never have given even a second thought to offering him around to other clubs. I want to watch Aaron Ramsey flourish as a player. Maybe he'll go to Juventus and do that, but I would much rather have watched him do it for Arsenal in the Premier League. I think he's a player who has something a lot of midfielders don't. A set of skills that very few have. A set of skills that make him a nightmare for people like defenders. You know, if you're Aaron Ramsey, you should be telling defenders, I will find you and I will skin you. I have to break some news that isn't Aaron Ramsey related, because the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, to everyone who's ever watched Suits, has given birth to a baby boy. Congratulations to Prince Harry and the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, as I suppose I'm supposed to call them. It's good news. Any birth of a child that's healthy is good news all round.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.